Justice delayed, but now a former D.C. firefighter will be released from prison.
Elon Wilson served nearly 2 years in jail after a traffic stop. And now a Fairfax County judge says the officer who arrested him lied on the police report.
Northern Virginia Bureau reporter Drew Wilder has new details in the story that we first told you about last week.
For nearly 2 years, the father of a young boy has sat in prison. Elon Wilson was a respected member of the D.C. Fire Department until he was pulled over by a police officer. Now a judge says that officer's lies landed Wilson in prison.
A man who put his life on the line on a regular basis to help the citizens of the District of Columbia, and it was all shattered by this case.
A case that's now being thrown out. Former Fairfax County Police Officer Jonathan Freitag is accused of racial profiling and found to have lied in the police report that led to Wilson's conviction. Late Tuesday, Fairfax County Judge Daniel Ortiz wrote, "Freitag's false statements undermined judicial integrity in the public's eyes and left a man sitting in prison for almost 2 years." The judge threw out the conviction, and this week, Elon Wilson will be freed from prison.
After Vanaz left her husband, she was worried that men were following her in the streets.
I recognised my face, and he hasn't come to my house ever, but I've seen him on occasions, on weddings and that. And even now, when I go out, I mean, one guy, as soon as I came out of the house, he was following me with a car. I heard someone calling my name in my language. So I turned around and he told me that he should give me a lift and I should go into his car. And I said no and just put my head down and keep walking. So that day he was just following me. People following me. Or still now they follow me. And that was the main reason that I came to the police station.
Okay.
That in the future or at any time, if anything happens to me, it's them.
If ever you're worried or afraid for your own safety, you must contact us straight away.
Yeah.
All right, I don't want you worrying, you know, when we can get somebody out. Even if it turns out to be nothing, at least, you know, for your own peace of mind.
Now that I'm giving this statement, what can you do for me?
You've given us lines of inquiry that we will need to follow up.
Okay.
But we will let you know of what's going on. Okay. As it's happening, really, just so that you're kept informed and up to date of, as to what's going on.
Okay.
By going to the police, Banaz was putting herself at great risk.
Monday the 10th of October 2005.
But the investigating officers did nothing to investigate her claims.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioural analyst, former New Scotland Yard, founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and host of the podcast Crime Analyst. And with me today is...
Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor, and co-host of the podcast Best Case, Worst Case.
And I'm Lisa Zampetti. I am casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds and host of Killer Casting, the podcast. And we're here to discuss HBO's new documentary, Black and Missing. This documentary was 3 years in the making, and it's foundation, a nonprofit organization fighting to bring awareness to missing Black people. And the focus of this series is around the founders, Derica Wilson and Natalie Wilson, who, like so many Black women before them, say, screw it, I'll do it. And that's exactly what they've been doing.
Yeah, and I'm glad we're back talking about this amazing series that's executive produced by Soledad O'Brien. And why don't we jump right back in? I think the first case that we should talk about is the case of Elon Wilson. And this is a little different than the other cases, but it was kind of an eye-opener for me, and it is actually true. And one thing that Natalie said that really opened my eyes was that there are missing African-American people, missing from the community because of police misconduct, because of false allegations because of being set up by cops, because some people racially profile these young men and women, these people end up being taken away from their families, and families can be destroyed by it. And it's all illegitimate. And this case that she talked about, her son, Elon, who was, I believe, a fireman, who was working at a recording studio late at night, and he was driving one of the young recording artists home at about 3 a.m. and was pulled over by a cop. Luckily, there's a dash cam, and the cop says, "I pulled you over because you crossed the lines on the road. And now that I'm talking to you, I smell marijuana, so I'm going to search your vehicle." And he searches and finds, not in the vehicle, but on the passenger, he finds some drugs and two guns. And the passenger was actually a juvenile. And they prosecuted Elon, who was an adult, for the guns and drugs that the passenger had. And there's no evidence that he even knew that they were in the car. And yet they prosecuted him. And he ended up taking a plea and agreeing to a 2-year sentence, I believe. But that took him away from his family and his little baby boy, who needed his father around and whose father was a good man, who didn't deserve to be singled out at all. But because of the situation, you know, and I think this is prosecutorial overextension. This is somebody who there should be prosecutorial discretion to not prosecute, even though technically these weapons and these drugs were in the car. He did not possess any of them. And the prosecutor very well could have just said, "I understand it wasn't you," and just gotten rid of it, the case. But that's not what happened.
In a backhanded irony, the media was all over his case. He was in the news, his arrest and his conviction. I just found that incredibly ironic, given how much media that Natalie is trying to give to victims who are missing, and yet her own son, right. You know what I mean?
And Lisa, this is something you and I dealt with over 15 seasons of Criminal Minds, that we didn't want to just depict African-American men as criminals, but wanted to put them and African-American women in positions of authority, in leadership positions, in educated positions, not just as the bad guys. And unfortunately, there's a history in Hollywood, in this country at least, I don't know about in London, the UK, or Australia, but in this country at least, of showing darker people as criminals, not intelligent, and not professionals. And that, unfortunately, helps reinforce negative stereotypes, biases, and racism. And we have to be responsible when we produce shows and any kind of entertainment, because that actually affects our communities. And we can do positive things and hopefully help undo these just really horrible, hurtful, and wrong negative stereotypes. The reason why the press was all over his arrest, Elon's arrest, was that he was a fireman. So he was in a position of authority and now is disgraced. That to them is, quote, news. But when a little girl or a young lady or a young man or a little boy goes missing and they happen to be non-white, that's not news. It's just crap. That's bullshit.
It just shows the bias, doesn't it? And it shows the allocation of resources. They're happy to resource law enforcement, police being out there, watching people going over yellow lines, but they're not happy to resource missing people cases.
Boom.
So again,
boom.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? That's the, I call it an epistemic imbalance. And mm-hmm. My detective chief superintendent, Johnny Godsave, always used to say to me, "I get so fed up with the officers on the ground saying they're busy." I always say to them, "Laura, are you busy with the right things? You can be busy, but are you busy with the right things? And if you're not, you either shape up or you ship on out." That was always his phrase that he would say. And that was when we set up the Racial and Violent Crime Task Force, because we know people want to be busy with certain jobs and not with other jobs. But these are the jobs that really matter. And yet you've got a police officer who's watching someone cross over a yellow line. Give me bloody strength. I mean, it's absolutely outrageous. And I think his dad summed it up, Walter, by saying he was really stopped because he was driving whilst black. He was racially profiled. It was 3 a.m. and that's why he was stopped. And that just makes me angry, because there was no reason, and that he found the next reason and the next reason. Why aren't they as persistent with serial perpetrators or with those who commit real harm? Why aren't those questions being asked? Why aren't the door knocks being done and then the next question being asked of the traffickers? That's the double standard that we keep seeing. And I have to say, those scenes were very emotional on the documentary for me, you know, watching the family and seeing Natalie so strong, talking about everybody else's cases and being an advocate. But when it happens to you, when it's your own family, and she got very choked up, and she said, whenever I talk to Elon, I get very, you know, upset. Her humanity, her mum part, talks in the sense that the emotion comes through. And that's why you need advocates to help you when you are disempowered through emotion. But you can also use that emotion as real fire, fire in the belly to do constructive things. But I just found all of that just very emotional. And of course, it's an arc across the docuseries, isn't it? Some of the cases arc across each of the episodes, and Elon's case is one of them. But the docuseries, we didn't say, it actually opens in episode one with the children. And I quite like that. We're situated in the family, first of all, because this, after all, is about families. Mm-hmm. And it's about what happens. As you said, Jim, missing people can be lots of different things. But when men are incarcerated for, you know, very minor things, and yet you've got serial killers, serial rapists getting away with it time and time again, it just beggars belief, and it destroys families, doesn't it? It destroys communities, and that trust and confidence gets destroyed.
You just made me think, Laura, you know, this cop who arrested Elon admits later that, yeah, he was basically waiting outside this music studio, staking out the music studio just to see who he could stop. But they won't fucking stake out a motel where they know that a missing girl is being held and possibly more. I mean, give me a fucking break. I'm sorry, but
or
I mean,
a home or a, you know, apartment complex, whatever. I mean, the whole point is it's whether it's driven by racism or hatred or bias of some kind or laziness. You know, when a cop decides, hey, this is what I'm going to do, I'm going to stake out this place because a certain type of people leave from that place, and I'm going to see what I can do. And then, you know, what he does is he calls them a pretext stop, and he's using it out of term. In other words, a pretext stop is when you have probable cause that this person is a killer, for example, and a dangerous person, and you don't want to take him down in his house or at his job, because that's where he would have the most control and other people would be at risk. So you wait till he gets in his car and you pull him over and say, oh, your brake light is off, so that's why we pulled you over. Can you step out of the car? And you arrest him, and he has no chance to hurt or kill anyone. That's a pretext stop. He's calling a pretext stop when you find something, when you have nothing on the people, and you pretend that you saw something that they, where they broke the law, you lie and then stop them for nothing, and then start searching based on no evidence and hope to find a crime. That is 100% by definition racial profiling. That is 100% illegal. It is not a pretext stop, which can be a legitimate way to save the lives of people around a very violent person. And that is bullshit. He says, and I don't know if he made it up or he was told this, not to put that in his reports. Was that because somebody was training him to commit crimes and cover it up? Or is that because he was just trying to cover up his own crimes and pawn it off on some kind of trainer? I don't know, but neither of them is legitimate. Both of them are crimes, and there's no way that guy should be a cop. He should be arrested and thrown in jail.
We do hear more about him and about his, should we say, rather nefarious police career. But right away, there are red flags, aren't there, when we're hearing about Elon's case. But I think it's, again, this is all about humanity, this docuseries, and why Derica and Natalie are doing what they do is because of the human spirit, because of things that have happened in their lives, and they're trying to help other people. And they're very strong voices across the docuseries. And like I said in the last episode, it's very dark and it could feel very helpless and disempowering. But actually, these women are so empowering, aren't they? And they have a laugh and a joke whilst they're doing it too. There are moments of levity. And I think you need to have that to stay sane. I'll say that as an advocate. It's the same as you're working on the front line in the trenches. It can be really tough, really wearing on you. And Lisa, you said, you know, Laura, you said one time you're going to open a tea shop because you've had enough. You do get to that point because the war of attrition of the next case, the next case, the next case, it's really tough work, you know, and the caseload is extremely high. And they have to find their moments of levity, but there aren't many in these years.
Laura, about that, you and I have done this for our careers. And what is it that drove you, though? It's the successes. If you get out there and do the work, if you get out there and save the kids, if you recover these people, that is, you know, what carries you through the next 100 cases where you can't. And so by not doing anything, all you're doing is reinforcing the negative. You can have great outcomes if you actually just do the work. Like you always say, just do your job. Just you do your job and you will find resolution to a number of these cases. Having them sit there and wait days, months, weeks, and years only makes it almost more impossible to have a good resolution.
Yeah, do the basics well, the rest will follow. And when I train detectives, when I train frontline officers, that's what I always say, get the basics right, the rest will follow. Jobs go wrong because the basics weren't ever done. And that's where I would say you catch a cold because you didn't follow the basic lines of standard operating procedures and investigations. You didn't look at the CCTV tapes, or you looked at three of them, not six of them. You didn't do the house to house. You missed one house and you didn't go back. And it's at that house he was last seen or she was last seen. You know, it's always they're blinding glimpses of the obvious, the BGOs, but they're so often missed. And I think there are so many moments in this docuseries where I'm like, that's just a BGO. It's a blinding glimpse of the obvious. We've even got camera footage that was seen. Why didn't they follow up on it? You know, it's really basic stuff, isn't it? But if it starts badly, it will end badly. And that's what I've seen across my whole career, time after time. So we in the docuseries, we also hear from Dr. Renee Murrell or Mural from formerly of the FBI, Jim. I'm not sure if you ever came across her work or you were aware of her at all.
I don't remember, actually, at this point. It would seem likely, but I just been out for a little over 11 years and I don't remember at this point.
I know you, across our careers, we meet so many people, but she talks specifically about wanting to do a scoping exercise and find out how many missing 13 to 17 year old girls there are in Baltimore at any one time. And we used to do these kind of scoping exercises. It's almost impossible, isn't it, to put
Database, right? There's nobody's collecting that information. I mean, you have the general FBI statistics, but they're not that specific. And a lot of these, unfortunately, are missing labeled, and therefore they don't get into a crime category. So they're not in crime statistics. That's why we need a crime category. And that is an umbrella term that covers those, because it's literally so misleading to just say they're missing when, you know, the facts and circumstances can scream out that they're actually murdered or abducted or even voluntarily gone, but endangered. Right, and maybe we should just drop the missing altogether and just go with endangered.
Or at risk, and then grades of at risk based on information obtained.
Right.
there's also the point, isn't it, Jim and Lisa, and I always used to say this at New Scotland Yard, that when someone's reported, well, that's one thing. What about all of those that aren't reported, where you haven't got a mum or someone asking questions? And one of the cases that's always in my mind, it's a case that haunted me across my career, was the murder of Benaz Mahmood. And we only knew that she was missing because she had a boyfriend. And the boyfriend, Ramat Soleimani, reported her missing, but nobody else did in her family. And nobody else did outside because she had no other friends. She wasn't allowed to have other friends outside the family. So the family policed her and coercively controlled her and micromanaged everything that she did. In fact, all of the daughters that they had, because there was a very strict honor code about how they must behave and about who they can talk to, be with, how they dress.
That would be at risk for honor killing then.
There you go. And that was one of the high profile cases, that 2 weeks after she had been reported as she had disappeared, was what her boyfriend said, Ramat Soleimani had said, and that she feared she was going to be killed. She had even reported to us 4 times that she was going to be killed. She even told us who it was that was going to kill her. And this was a borough investigation. And at no point was it raised or elevated in terms of it being a priority case. 2 weeks later, the head of homicide walked into my office with a missing briefing slide with her picture on it. And it said, missing high risk, might be a victim of honor-based violence. And I looked at her history. My boss said, can you have a look at it, please? Out of all the cases in London, this is the case I'm worried about. Says she's missing, but is she more than that, Laura? What can you find for me? So I spent literally less than an hour searching our databases, less than an hour. And I find that she had reported 4 times. She told us who was going to kill her. The crime reports were written up very well. I then asked, could we put a family liaison officer into Ramat Soleimani, who was her boyfriend, which we did. And my question was, how often do you talk to Benaz? He said, at least 4 times a day. Most often we say goodnight, like literally every night, and I've heard nothing from her. And I'm really worried. And now it was 2 weeks down the line and there was no movement on her telephone, or I should say no communication from her phone, no movement of funds from her account. So everything was saying that what she had self-prophesized about what was going to happen had happened. And now we were into, as I said to my boss, this is about body recovery, unfortunately. There's a high probability that she's dead. And then we put a murder team on it. And the murder team did a great job. We found her body within 3 months. And I say did a great job because all the resources go to murder teams and to the detectives. You have the luxury. This is when I was running the homicide prevention unit. You have the luxury of all the resources when you're working murder. But when she had been disappeared, that's when the resources were required. She knew exactly what was going to happen to her. And I gulp saying it because it's a case that as I was finding and revealing all of these things, I just felt such sadness that if the case had come to me early on, maybe, just maybe, we would have found her. But 2 weeks down the line, I already knew that everything that she had told us had now happened and we were right at the end of it. So yes, it was cold comfort when we found her body 3 months later, buried in a suitcase underneath one of her family relatives' houses up north in Birmingham. Not only had they killed her and tortured her, they also raped her because they decided that, seeing as they had the opportunity to do that, that's what they did. And absolutely horrific that it was her own family who sanctioned her death, and multiple people, 5 other people were involved in it.
Oh, geez.
So it really, you know, comes at high cost when you don't take cases seriously. And particularly in that case, I always, when I teach others on it, because I still, when I'm running classes, I use Benaz's case. We didn't just have one chance to get it right. We had 4 chances. But I always say you have a one chance rule. You know, when someone reports and they're fearful they're going to be killed, and then they give you chapter and verse on their culture and honor, and they say, don't come round my house because it's my mom and dad who said they're going to kill me. And then 2 officers knock on the front door and asks to speak to her, and she runs up to the bathroom and hides. And it's written up as her being a hostile witness rather than asking questions as to why she might behave like that. You know, literally, we got everything wrong. And I say we, it was a collective. And why I spent so much time looking at so-called honor killings, and I don't even like the terminology, is because it does affect certain cultures, and it's more cultural, not religious. But more often than not, we are told what's going to happen, and then someone disbelieves because it sounds too fantastical, and so disbelieves it. But we had four opportunities to do the right thing. And I think with a lot of these cases, what we're seeing on Black and Missing is that there are multiple opportunities actually to get things right if someone just does the basics well. And if you listen to what you're being told, and I mean really listen and not just disregard what a victim tells you, it comes down to communication skills again. So yes, there are always cases that haunt us, and that's certainly one of mine where I just feel we could have prevented a young woman's brutal murder, well, rape and murder. It did end up in a trial. I guess that's one of the positive things. But in my view, running the homicide prevention unit,
you could have prevented it. Yeah.
Yeah. We could have prevented it. And you save lives, but you also save money, because how much time and resource is put into you respond four times, but you respond badly. Now, and we costed it, it's about £1,000 to respond each time minimum. It's probably far more than that now, but a murder to investigate at that time cost about £1.54 million. Now it's in the region of £3 to £4 million. So it's a huge amount of money as well, isn't it? That when you cost it financially, and so, unfortunately, sometimes you have to talk from a financial point of view, the cost of failure, well as from a human cost, which I always go for the human cost first. But there is a price on justice too, and there is a price around investigations, and there's a price on prevention. You could save money and save lives.
That, I'm exhausted by you telling me that, Laura. I can't even comprehend that story. I'm so glad that you shared it and horrified at the same time. Oh my God.
So yeah, I agree. It's horrific. And I mean,
it just reminds me that what you've done before, Laura, you know, with your work with domestic abuse, you know, victims, they're telling you this man is going to kill me. You know, why don't we believe them?
Because we don't listen. We don't listen well to, in particular, women, in particular, children. But I do think with women, and if you layer in Black or brown, if you layer in people of color, even more so, that are disproportionately affected, but I believe disproportionately dismissed and not believed. And people have asked me more recently, did I believe there was a racial bias in Banaz's case? And I do believe that she was seen as manipulative and disruptive, things that were written on a crime report, which when I read the reports, that's not how I interpreted her behavior at all. I interpreted her behavior as someone who was in trauma, who was desperate for help. And I've recently been using some of the footage when she reported rape by her husband that she was forced to marry. We've got video footage of her, and she's so small and she's malnourished, the way she's holding herself. She's clearly injured. She's so softly spoken and she's so desperate for help. What can you do to help me? What can you... How might you then be able to help me now I've told you all of this? And the officer says, oh, we're follow up, we'll do X, Y, and Z. She didn't hear anything for weeks. No one ever got back to her. It wasn't ever even investigated when she reported that her husband had been, she didn't say coercively controlling, but all the horrific things that he'd been doing to her. You know, and I use that footage in training to show police officers how victims are discriminated against, how they're not believed, how police may make a promise that they'll do A, B, and C, but then they don't even follow up, and there's no investigation at all. So I think it's about 40%, and I think it's a statistic that they use in the program where they say 40% of women of color experience domestic abuse, but most actually do not report. Therefore, if you have got someone reporting, it's much more likely to be significant risk because they don't want to come through police doors and report it. There's huge barriers to overcome to do that. And with Banaz, she really put herself more at risk by talking to police officers, because actually we increase the risk. And I think that is a huge challenge for policing. It's a double bind. And that's why I still spend so much time training. I still believe that everyone can get better and do better, but it starts with wanting to. And why I was pleased that so many police officers contacted me over the weekend is that many of them were saying, we want to get better and we're listening to your podcast because we want to improve. They're not being defensive. They're saying, I'm vowing that I will do better and I'll play my part, and I'll speak up. That's but it's awesome. Not always easy to. Yeah. But yeah, that is the good stuff that comes out of us doing these podcasts and talking about these very difficult cases and subject matters.
So, Laura, I'm glad you told us that story. It's a horrific story. And to think of what that girl had to go through. I mean, she didn't have to go through. To think of what she went through. And she could have been saved. She gave four opportunities before, you know, she went missing. And in fact, she wasn't missing at all. I mean, she was actually abducted by her family and raped and killed. And it was an execution. And I can't imagine how horrible it is when the very people who are supposed to be your protectors are the ones who are actually attacking you. And they're standing on some kind of moral bullshit to do it. It's such a horrific thing when kids have to deal with not only unreasonableness on the part of their parents, but then this rationalization and justification of torturing that kid and murdering that kid. And then, you know, sort of just going on with their lives. I mean, it's just horrific. And you said you don't like the term honor killings, and I would love to get rid of it if we had another term to describe that. Is there something else that describes that?
Not very well. I mean, we thought about it long and hard, and we talked about it with academics, we talked about it with community members, with women's groups, and there was no one other term that everybody could agree on. And you know, sometimes the victims would talk about it in that term, that it's about transgression of this honor code. But I do want to make it very clear, there is no honor in violence or murder, and I always say that. It's just a term that people now collectively understand, that there is an honor code. It can happen whether you're a traveling family. It's not just about people of color, but more often than not, we are talking about people of color, and therefore the cases get dismissed.
Isn't it really femicide, Laura? I mean, basically, I mean, the boys aren't held to this honor code, are they? It's the women, it's the girls to control them.
Well, sometimes boys and men can be harmed and killed too, particularly if they're gay, and that is a transgression against religion, culture. So I have seen male victims. Ostensibly, it is femicide, and more often than not, it's women that are being killed. And just look at Turkey, where you've got, I think it's three women a day, three or four women a day. Yeah, their figures absolutely terrifying in many senses. And there was a media blackout where media weren't even allowed to report on it last year. And I don't know if you saw on social media where people were posting black and white pictures of themselves. That was all in solidarity to what was going on in Turkey. But these sorts of so-called honor cases happen all across the globe. And it's really about rigid gender roles of what's expected for boys and girls and women and men. And if you transgress that cultural, they might say it's religious, but I see it across all religions. But if you transgress a code, and for Benaz, she had been married into a family and she then left him and she started a new relationship, and she was seen with Ramat in public. And it was the community, it was members of the community that said, put a letter through the family's door to say, if you don't sort your daughter out, we will. She's shaming all of us because she was seen in public. So they all held that it was a dishonor to all of them, the community, not just the family.
Well, you just said the answer then. I'm sorry, Laura, but you should call it dishonor killings. Right. Or shame killings, because honor killings does not, it does not represent what's happening. It's dishonor to do what they're doing. And it's shameful to do what they're doing. And it's criminal to do what they're doing.
Yeah, the shame and dishonor is on those who are doing the killing.
Yes, not the victims. Exactly.
Absolutely. And again, the numbers we were scoping, similar to like trafficking, how many people are affected? We found 12 potential so-called honor killings in London in a short period of time. It was my unit that was looking at this, and we were called racist for doing it, because many years previously we'd had the murder of Stephen Lawrence, and there was a public inquiry, and the Met was found to be institutionally racist. And here was I looking at these so-called honor cases. But I wasn't saying that it's a black issue or it's a brown issue. And I wasn't talking about race or religion. I was talking about, really, it's a human rights issue. And the human rights issue, surely that must be more important, the right to life, mm-hmm. the right to life for everybody. But the cases that we found, these 12, I mean, we know that there were many others, but who decides whether it's an honor killing or not? If it's a new term that a lot of detectives, they weren't familiar with, or they weren't familiar with the motivation, it wasn't ever written up as that. And so the true questions, or the best questions, hadn't been asked. Now we count those cases, and there are lots of women's rights organizations that work on so-called honor abuse, and it cuts across all different types of crime. But it's still really an area that many people don't understand or know anything about. And I remember talking about it in the FBI for the first time, Jim, mm-hmm. when I came over, and lots of your colleagues looked at me as if I had two heads.
Really?
You know, and a few people said, good luck with that problem that you have in London, Laura, as if it was just a London problem. But it's across the globe. And, you know, if you Google it, you'll see that there are lots of organizations now, grassroots, really shining the light on it and advocating. And I spent a lot of my time at New Scotland Yard helping at least two victims every day stay alive. Yeah. You know, how do you count how many cases that you've prevented? That's all prevented right. from escalating to murder. But my unit, we spent a lot of time working on the murders, but also keeping people alive. So it is something I know a lot about, of trust and confidence issues, and why people don't talk to us. When I was in the Met, it's normally because we put our size 10 feet in it. And unfortunately, we asked the wrong questions and took the wrong action. And now you hope things are getting slightly better, and they are. But we need docuseries like this to show us, and we need advocates, bringing it back to Derica and Natalie. We need advocates like them and Derek holding our hands and helping us ask the right questions, have the right conversations, and have those conversations when actually it's not appropriate for the police to. There are times when it's better coming from Derica, it's better coming from Natalie, than it is from a white 60-year-old, 50-year-old male police officer. And that's something that we learned in London, that it's not always about, we can still police, but we police in partnerships. We right. police with other agencies, we police with advocates, and we create strong partnerships because we're stronger working together, and it's not just about the police. And I think a lot of that still doesn't really happen over here. And that's why I'm, you know, huge fans of Derica and Natalie, because they are doing the job, really, of law enforcement in many respects.
They really yeah, are. And they're absolutely. Just not stopping. They just keep going and going and going. They're undeterred.
Right. Well, we have just barely scratched the surface of this series. It's so many issues that are raised in the series, and cases, and just heart-wrenching cases. But I think we need to go through every single one of them, and we need to get people educated as to how these things happen so that we can help prevent it in the future. So please come back to us next week when we continue our coverage of Black and Missing and this amazing, intense, but also very human docuseries on HBO, Black and Missing. Until next time, this is Real Crime Profile, signing off.
If you like deeper analysis like this episode on topics like Making a Murderer, Mindhunter, Escape at Dannemora,
the case of Sally Challen, the teacher's pet, Lynette Dawson, the exonerated five in When They See Us, and the disappearance of Madeleine McCann, you can listen to RCP on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever platform you listen to us on. And please be sure, if you like what we do, to give us a 5-star review.
Thank you for listening to Real Crime Profile. Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.